Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Elizabeth Woodworth. Next week, next Wednesday, we're coming up to the 12th anniversary of the infamous, notorious 9/11 attack. When we discuss 9/11 on this program, we do exactly what Elizabeth does and her work involved with Consensus 9/11. It spreads 9/11 truths. It discounts the bald-faced lies that you hear through the mainstream media. Well, that's not what Elizabeth does. That's certainly not what I do. That's not what people wanting to spread important information, and I can't imagine anything more important than 9/11, because we all know the horrors that followed as a result of that date. Before I get into that with Elizabeth, and I mentioned this to Elizabeth, the head of the program, and I welcome her comments on this. Much is going on around the world, especially in the Middle East, especially in Syria. This program has been devoted heavily to explaining what's going on, again, to discounting the official lies, and I guarantee you, well, you don't need to be guaranteed. Anyone listening to this program understands very well that the stuff coming out of Washington from Obama, from John Kerry, from other U.S. officials, their spokespersons, their lies, their damn lies, their bald-faced lies. There is nothing truthful about what they're saying. The claims they make about Assad being responsible for using chemical weapons, again, I repeat, they're bald-faced lies. There's no question about it. The evidence is overwhelming. The only leader with the backbone enough to come out and say this in point-blank terms, Vladimir Putin, president of Russia, in St. Petersburg at the G20 summit, he called John Kerry a liar. Quote, unquote. Can you imagine a leader having the courage, I don't say the audacity, I say the courage to call a spade, John Kerry is a liar. He's the guy who replicated four Colin Powell moments. He did it first at length. He did it before two congressional committees. He did it one other time. Four times he replicated Colin Powell's infamous February 2003 moment when he lied about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist, and he knew it, and he claimed they did anyway. And we know what happened from that. The cradle of civilization was destroyed. Iraq today is a cauldron of violence, absolute cauldron of violence. Besides that, massive unemployment, poverty, extreme human deprivation, a cataclysm of birth defects, a plague of cancers. All of this is covered up in the mainstream. You'll never hear a word about this in the major media. But I've written articles on it. I'm sure I'll do more as new information comes out. Vast parts of Iraq are irradiated because radiological weapons were used, chemical weapons were used, biological weapons were used. America uses these weapons in all its wars. The Syrian military has used chemical weapons zero times. Zero times. And I would point out, I believe I have before, why on earth would they even want to use them? They are literally routing these insurgents very effectively. They're no match for the superior Syrian military. And that's the main reason why Obama wants to launch an attack against Syria. He wants to level the battlefield. He wants to give these insurgents, who I call Western enlisted death squads, same thing as back in the 1980s, the Salvador option. Salvador option was in, El Salvador, Nicaragua, death squads recruited by the U.S., CIA, other U.S. agencies, to wage a covert and overt war against a legitimately democratic elected government, especially of Nicaragua. It's been a while since I've written about that, but I sure have. And finally, after years and many thousands of deaths, they prevailed. There was no air power given these people, so it was all done on the ground. But the so-called Contras, they were death squads. They were recruited, trained, armed, etc., by the U.S. Same thing is going on in Syria now. Same thing went on in Libya in 2011. Death squad diplomacy, and Obama wants to add cruise missile diplomacy to that. That's the scheme. Well, he may have been blindsided in St. Petersburg. He came to enlist support. G20 countries, the 20 most important economic countries in the world, they gather once a year mainly to discuss economic and related issues, trade issues, investment issues. And the final declaration, which I included in one of the articles I wrote, said nothing about Syria. Astonishing. Nothing about, I went through it very quickly. I mean, it was all economics, trade, etc. That was the document. And, of course, there were major issues to be addressed there. But on the sidelines, many, many hours were devoted to discussing Syria. Well, Obama found to his dismay that instead of enlisting a majority support, he really enlisted a minority support. Most of the countries supporting him were far less important than the countries opposing him, including the so-called BRICS countries, China, India, South Africa, Russia. Did I leave one out? Anyway, five major countries. Germany, of all countries, very much a NATO partner, very much supporting Obama's wars. Germany believes that something should be done about the chemical weapons attacks, but it categorically opposes military intervention. So put Germany up in the negative column, a major defeat for Obama. Put Britain in the negative column, the most major defeat for Obama. Well, British Prime Minister David Cameron absolutely supports Obama. But for the first time since, dare I say, maybe the 17th or 18th century, astonishing, the British Parliament voted against its own Prime Minister, meaning the majority rule in the Parliament said no to its own Prime Minister, and David Cameron could do nothing else but accept a hugely embarrassing climb down. Well, Obama faces a hugely embarrassing climb down. He faces tremendous opposition at home. Right now, it looks like Congress may vote him down. Very unusual in a situation like this. Overwhelming public opposition to his attacking Syria. I put on an article this morning titled Global Opposition to Obama's Initiative to Attack Syria. Overwhelming. Congressmen are getting carpet bombed with constituent opposition. The numbers are astonishing. 10-1, 50-1, 100-1. One congressman said something like, if I remember the exact number, 495 of all the emails or phone calls he's gotten, 495 against 1-4. A Republican. Can you imagine that? One after another congressman, Democrats and Republicans I quoted, saying exactly the same thing. And a few of them said, I had planned to support Obama, but after hearing from my constituents, there's no way I can do it. Right now, the count in Congress is against Obama in the House. It's Republican-controlled. The Senate is Democrat-controlled. I think the Senate will go along with them, but it's no slam dunk, because they're getting carpet-bombed also. It's no slam dunk. Obama may find out he's losing House and Senate, but odds favor is losing the House. That would be a major, major defeat. Earlier he said, and I don't want to continue this too long because I want to get Elizabeth involved on Syria and especially on Consensus 9/11. This program does not run on Wednesday 9/11 day, so I'm using this weekend to do it today and tomorrow. Graham Greene will be on tomorrow. We'll be discussing 9/11. I'll give another brief Syria update if there's anything important to relate. But early on, Obama said he doesn't care what the Congress votes. He doesn't care about the UN Security Council that has the only authority, not the only, the final authority on whether or not a nation can attack another one. It can only do so in self-defense, no other reason, with no exceptions. And it can only do it until the Security Council acts. It can either allow the attack to continue or it can order it stopped. And there's no overriding authority. Any law, any convention, any international law that America is a signatory to, and it most certainly is to the UN Charter, where these provisions are stated, they automatically become U.S. constitutional law. Under Article 6, Clause 2, the Supremacy Clause, they become, quote-unquote, the supreme law of the land. Congress may enact no law violating the UN Charter, let alone, well, violating the U.S. Constitution, let alone the U.S. Charter. If Congress authorizes war on Syria, it's doing it unconstitutionally. There are plenty of lawyers in the Congress. I'm not a lawyer. I know it. Anyone who knows how to read can read the law. It's in plain English. It says it very clearly. It's unequivocal. Congress may enact no law. Those are my words, not the Constitution's. Constitution refers to the supreme law of the land, which means you can't enact a law contrary to the supreme law of the land. That's pretty obvious. So it's touch and go. And right now the odds favor Obama losing. He's going to give a speech next Tuesday. He's going to give it one more try. He's sending out his shock troops, everybody fanning out, giving talks, spreading the big lies about the necessity to protect U.S. national security, therefore we must attack Syria. When on earth has Syria, in its entire history, post-World War I, and then when it gained independence from France, has never once threatened U.S. security? France is the only country U.S. America can rely on to join it in partnering with its attack on Syria. Well, Syria was once a French colony. Maybe it has recolonization in mind. It'll have to get in line because America has the same idea in its own way. But even Francois Hollande, the president of France, at first was very, very vehement about joining Obama's coalition. And now he says he wants to wait until the UN issues its report. It may be a couple of weeks or longer. He wants to wait until Congress acts. Maybe soon. It may take a little longer. So even he's equivocating. Obama more and more is out on a limb by himself. Elizabeth, I could keep this going, but I want to bring you in, and I certainly want to focus the rest of the program, other than any comments you might have on Syria, to talking consensus 9/11.
Hello, Stephen. It's good to talk to you again, and I really enjoyed listening to what you've just said. I think you really hit the nail on the head about Syria. I have a few comments to make from another perspective, and that is that I realized a few months ago that I'd never seen Dr. Assad on the news. And then, so I went to YouTube, and I found a few interviews with him from a German journalist. And I was astounded to find a very reserved and polite and articulate and logical human being, a medical doctor who was educated in England, who married a London-born English woman. His wife has won humanitarian awards for her work. And I listened to him speak about the foreign intrusions into Syria and how so much of what is going on there is being stoked by rebels from outside the country. And that prompted me to write an article, which was published on Global Research. I think it was about April or May. And since then I found out that Dr. Assad had never wanted to be in politics. His older brother was the man who was supposed to succeed the father in the family politics. And Bashar, the younger kid, never went to visit his father in his office. He wanted to study medicine. But his older brother was killed in a car accident, and that meant that Bashar had to take the reins. So that's the context for where he is. Yes, on September the 4th, I've been on Twitter hours every day looking at the response to this Syria issue, and everybody, like you say, Stephen, everybody's opposed to it. And in fact, there's a letter that was issued by the Syrian speaker of the Syrian House of Representatives, whatever they call it there, and it was sent to the Speaker of the Congress, a long letter outlining the difficulties and saying what we want is peace. We want to have diplomatic negotiations with you. And it's a beautiful letter. You can find it if you go to Twitter or YouTube. You can just, Google, and you can find that letter and read it for yourself. It's about four pages long. The other thing that's been happening every day is Paul Craig Roberts, who used to be very high up in the Reagan administration. I believe he's an economist.
Yes, and a regular on this program, Elizabeth.
Is he? Oh,
yes.
I did hear him, Stephen. And he is also the assistant editor of the Wall Street Journal. And
well,
he was.
They don't publish him anymore. Now that he's joined the chorus, the anti-war chorus and the rest, they won't touch him.
I'm sure. Then that's why he has to go alternative.
Yes,
but
sir.
Every day he is writing up the latest on Syria, and it's worth following his blog, too. I just wanted to mention that.
Oh, he does a wonderful, wonderful article. I love quoting him, Elizabeth. I absolutely love quoting him. I must add that Bashar Assad, indeed, he's an ophthalmologist. He never dreamed that he'd get himself in politics, but now he ended up the president of Syria around the year 2000 after his father died. I don't like the presidency being passed on from father to son, but he's a very level-headed guy, as you say, very mild-mannered. He's given interviews to German media, to Russian media, to the French media. The U.S. media don't go anywhere near him.
Well, because their credibility would be completely destroyed
yes.
if they ever showed him speaking even one sentence.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that shows you in itself, in that simple one, that one fact shows you that it is a pack of lies because they will not even show the man that they're demonizing.
Elizabeth, let me add two more things as well very quickly. Last year, Assad did two very, very important things. What he did was absolutely trashed by U.S. officials and the U.S. media, what I call the scoundrel media. He drafted a brand new constitution. He made revisions in it after public suggestions were made. He put it to a national referendum while all this conflict was going on. He gave the public the right to vote on this up or down. It passed overwhelmingly. I forget the percentage, but it was an overwhelming majority that voted to adopt this constitution. He held, I believe it was in May last year, he held Syria's first ever parliamentary elections. Independent candidates ran, as well as dominant Ba'ath Party candidates. Syrians gave the Ba'ath Party more support in this election than they gave them previously. They supported the Assad government. It's unsurprising, Elizabeth, because when a nation is being attacked, who else do people have to rely on than their government? The Iraqis relied on Saddam even though they hated him. The
yeah.
Libyans relied on Gaddafi even though they supported him before the conflict broke out. But
yeah.
at the end of the conflict, polls showed 90% support for Gaddafi. So even NATO conducted
yeah.
a poll that I quoted showing 70% of Syrians support Assad.
Yeah. And the fact that these Middle Eastern countries are being targeted this way was told by General Wesley Clark, as you know, your listeners
yes.
may not know,
yes.
that right after 9/11, General Wesley Clark went in to talk to his former colleagues in the Pentagon, and they were astonished to tell him that there was a plan in place to take out seven Middle Eastern countries in the next 5 years, and this is the neocon plan. And it's, you know, it's what is called the deep state or the shadow government. People aren't aware that all the time that presidents change, meanwhile, under the surface, deep down, these more powerful interests are shaping policy. And this Wesley Clark's comments are available on YouTube. If you go, it was on, he made them. He waited until 2007 to make them publicly. To Amy Goodman, but it's right there, and you can see what the deep state has been up to. I should add at this point, Stephen, that my remarks about Syria are strictly my own. I'm on your show partly to represent the 9/11 consensus panel, which has 24 working members and 6 honorary members, and the 30 of us. So. When I speak on behalf of the panel, which is coming up, that will be wearing a different hat. I'd just like to make that clear.
Oh, indeed. Indeed, Elizabeth. And we certainly agree on that. And the only reason I continue to discuss Syria is because it is an extremely important event. I've written many times in articles. I keep repeating the same thing. Syria is a very strategically important country. Attacking Syria is a much bigger enterprise than attacking Iraq or attacking Libya. Syria is closely allied. It's an independent country, and the idea is to destroy its independence. That was the same agenda in Libya, the same one in Iraq. It had nothing to do with the leadership of these countries. And the idea is to topple Assad, isolate Iran, go after Hezbollah in Lebanon, and let Israel emerge as the sole dominant nation in the region, and head America toward its greater goal of sole global dominance. And I must say, it's important that Assad not be toppled. Also, an all-out war that would create a vastly greater catastrophe in Syria that's ongoing now could literally embroil the entire region in conflict. And if that happens, it's already spilled cross-border into Lebanon, into Turkey a little bit, into Jordan a little bit. It absolutely will spread further. And if the region gets inflamed in conflict, it could spread beyond the region. It literally could go global. And Vladimir Putin of Russia has said that if Syria is attacked, he will help Syria. He didn't go into great specifics, but he says he's supplying arms. He absolutely is on the side of preventing a conflict, a war against Syria, and he knows the potentially catastrophic consequences, so he's very, very much involved in this. I think he has his own red line, and he's deployed his own warships to the Eastern Mediterranean, along with the U.S. flotilla that's there right now. I don't think he's gonna attack U.S. ships. I don't think he has that in mind at all. But he's showing the flag. He's showing his extreme irateness and fear about the potential catastrophe if something like this happens, and he's right. So it's vital to prevent this. Hopefully it can happen, but it's a very, very, very tough fight. The other comment I wanted to make, and this segues right into consensus 9/11, Elizabeth, the 9/11 event was literally an open sesame for everything that's going on now. It was the new Pearl Harbor, in the words of the Project for the New American Century, PNAC, that literally let all of this stuff happen. It might have happened much more slowly and gradually and with much greater hardship, even had that event not happened. But that's what PNAC said. It needed this new Pearl Harbor to launch their agenda to go after these countries to advance America's imperium, and that's why the 9/11 event is so important. You have some new information, Elizabeth. Please, let's devote the rest of the program to discussing it, plus any other comments you'd like to make.
Oh, thank you very much, Stephen. I'm very glad we discussed Syria. It's just a terrible situation at the moment. Before I go into the information, I should just give a brief overview of what we are, the 9/11 consensus panel at consensus911.org. We review both old and newly discovered scientific, technical, and testimonial evidence that challenges the official account of 9/11. We use a medical evaluation model called the Delphi method to arrive at consensus on the best evidence in relation to specific claims of the official story of 9/11. The 24 panelists are blind to each other during three rounds of independent review of any particular point that we finally publish. And we now have 37 points. And so today I'm here to discuss the first, the last 5 points that we're just introducing this weekend. And I should tell you that we have some very key figures on this panel, especially some of our honorary members who are supporting us, although they're not working, but their names are up on the panel and their photos and bios. And this includes the honorary president of the Italian Supreme Court, Ferdinando Imposimato, a sitting British member of parliament, a former German cabinet minister, and several others. James W. Douglas, who wrote JFK and the Unspeakable, is also a new member of the panel, and his book is really an excellent book on JFK. Oliver Stone wrote a review saying that it was the best book that had ever been written on the assassination of Kennedy. So that's who we are. We're a group of people. We've been working together for the last 2 years to get to these points. And so I'll just sort of launch into them now. I was going to, I have to read this information. Some of it's pretty complicated, but I'll make it as simple as I can. The first point I think we should look at is called, did the official simulation of the fall of World Trade Center 7 match the observed collapse? And as many people know, World Trade Center Building 7 fell down very quickly into its own footprint at 5:20 in the afternoon on September 11th. That was a huge building. It's bigger than any building in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is close to where I live. 47-story steel frame building with a base as big as a football field. And that building just came straight down with a level roof line in 6 1/4 seconds. It just came, there was no resistance. It came down as fast as if you dropped a brick off the top of it and watched the brick come down with the top of the building. So the government, NIST agency, National Institute of Standards and Technology, spent 7 years trying to explain how this happened without the use of controlled demolition, which, incidentally, on the day of 9/11, all the anchors on the media, and a lot of that material has disappeared from the web now, but a lot of the anchors were saying, oh, that looks just like a controlled demolition. But so NIST really had their work cut out for them to try and figure out a way to explain this in other terms. And they ended up with the story that the fires caused it. Office fires. And those office fires were caused because some debris from the adjacent world, the Twin Towers, which is about a block away, some of this, that debris got kind of impaled through the windows of WTC 7. And there were some small fires around the 12th floor and other floors, but they were small fires. They were never engulfing fires. So it was a mystery. Why did this building drop so suddenly? And so the NIST has created, this is our point, NIST created a computer simulation, which is quite laughable because it's meant to show how it happened. And they said, well, really what happened was that inside the building where you couldn't see, it was all collapsing. And what you finally saw that makes it look like a controlled demolition was that the outer shell, after the whole inside had collapsed, the outer shell decided to collapse suddenly. So, and they have a simulation, which if you go to the point on our consensus911.org, you can see that their simulation. And what they've got in the simulation is this twisted, deformed building. It was all they could come up with, feeding their data into the computer program. They came up with this twisted, deformed thing that falls in a completely different way than what is visible to anybody looking at WTC-7 falling on YouTube. All you have to do is plug World Trade Center 7 into YouTube, and you've got thousands of different videos there showing the way it fell. So the second point is that there was no window breakage on the outside of the building leading up to the free fall of the building, which there should have been if the inside was collapsing. Behind the scenes sort of thing. And the third thing is that their simulation was cut short. It doesn't cover the whole period of the free fall. It only covers the part that suited them to come up with something that they considered plausible and which nobody else does. So and finally, on this point, NIST refused to release its computer models. And they were claiming that it was a progressive collapse inside the building, and even though it looked like a sudden collapse outside the building, it's not compatible to have a progressive collapse happening at the same time as an instant collapse, you can't achieve that experimentally. So that's that point, that new point. We're a bunch of academics, and we're basically giving the background and the depth to the events of 9/11 that will ultimately, we hope, persuade the media and the public to accept the fact that 9/11 was probably a false flag operation, and the first false flag operation designed to meet its objectives in the Middle East.
Elizabeth, we need to take a break in just a moment. I've written a number of articles about U.S. false flags. The fact that most domestic ones are initiated by the FBI, the evidence on that alone, that's unrelated to 9/11, except the ones that I discussed, took place in the aftermath of 9/11, where innocent Muslims are falsely accused of things they never planned, never intended, never dreamed of, and yet the FBI entraps them deceptively, and people, innocent people, go to prison, including people who never went anywhere near the notion of doing anything, including the principals of the largest Muslim charity in the country, who, and I've discussed them on this program, once had a relative, I believe the daughter of one of the principles on way, way back months ago, but these people did extraordinary charity work, and they were targeted. The Bush administration shut them down. Three or five of its principals were in prison. The two main ones for 65 years. They never committed a crime. This is the kind of stuff that went on in the aftermath of 9/11. So very much more. We need to take a quick break, Elizabeth, and we'll come right back, and I'll let you pick up.
Thank you.
This is PRN, the comprehensive news source for the world's progressive community. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Join us on our new show for ideas for a better planet and new ways to live over 100 years. I'm Bobby Elias, the host for Let's Create a Better World. Health, positive living, nature, being grateful, yoga, meditation, love, and sex. A lot to cover. Saturdays, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Gary Null's incisive documentary and informational films on today's most crucial issues have won dozens of international awards. As a free service to listeners, acclaimed films such as War on Health and Seeds of Death are available to watch in their entirety online. Just go to YouTube and search for Gary Null. Thank you for your continued support.
This is Mike Fader. Let me tell you about PRN.FM. It's a whole new world of broadcasting. PRN has absolutely no question the best political and economic shows on the radio. Plus, PRN tops every other station in its health and wellness program. Cooking, music, book reviews, sex advice, you name it, we have it. I'm going to tell you this one time. You need to listen to our programming, okay? All right? Don't make me come down here. This is Mike Fader. I want to tell you about my show, The Turning Point, broadcast every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. It's not just politics or pop culture or art or personal essays or storytelling. It's all of those. And it's in a spontaneous blend of stream of consciousness expression. It's not bad. Sex, children, work, beauty, ecstasy, death, regeneration. That's The Turning Point every Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern on PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Now, you don't have to come with us, but what would the neighbors say?
PRN.FM, bringing you new shows and fresh ideas every day. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. I'm talking with Elizabeth Woodworth, discussing consensus 9/11. New information, Elizabeth and her compatriots collects information vital to know, vital to provide more incriminating evidence that the 9/11 event was state-sponsored. And it's not doing it by supposition. It's doing it by hot facts that are collected piece by piece. And that's the aim of consensus 9/11. Elizabeth, let me let you pick up where you left off.
Thanks, Stephen. Actually, I should make it clear that the panel doesn't actually say where the energy for 9/11 came from. We're trying to stick to simply refuting the official story. It can be implied, it can be inferred through what we find where things were being run from, but we don't actually make those conclusions ourselves. Because we're hoping that this, we use the same model that is used in medicine to establish consensus statements to guide medical practice worldwide. So that's what we do. We try to achieve that level of objectivity. The next point I'd like to discuss that's new is about seismic evidence, and there have been some recent studies to show that. This has been known for a while, but the studies are new. Seismic waves were detected at seismograph stations in New York and four neighboring states on 9/11, and during the period when the towers were struck and when they collapsed. The official account says that the waves were caused by the airplane impacts into the Twin Towers. And the collapses themselves. So there were two sets of waves. But independent analyses have been undertaken, and they dispute the conclusions that were reached by FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Authority, and NIST. And the best evidence that we've been able to come up with through our panel reviewing technique is that the results of these independent researchers agree on certain things, and one of them is that the plane impacts could not have caused the seismic waves because they originated several seconds before the radar-based times of impact, which the 9/11 Commission referred to. The seismic events caused by the explosions were timed with the explosions in the basements of the Twin Towers, and there's much physical and testimonial evidence to support this. One of the independent researchers, Dr. Andre Russo, made three points. The radar-based timing of the airplane impacts do not match the origin times of the seismic waves. And the lack of explanation of why, although the two towers were destroyed in essentially the same way, the data show large differences between them in terms of released energy. This is kind of complicated, but it gives you an idea, if it's not turning your readers off too much, of the level of research that we are doing. And the frequencies of the waves were much too low to have been caused by plane impacts and building collapses. So they have basically related these enormous impacts to explosions that occurred down in the sub-basements of the Twin Towers. And there's a lot of physical, of testimonial and physical evidence to support the seismic evidence. I won't go into it. There's so much of it. It's in a separate point called Why Did the Twin Towers Collapse? Physical and Testimonial Evidence. And that's, you know, as long as your arm, it's just a whole lot of firemen and other professional people who were at the site in that day who heard these explosions, including a BBC reporter who was there. You can see all of this. You can listen to their actual testimonials on YouTube. So this is the seismic point, which is new.
Elizabeth, you may have included this in some of your material, the infamous BBC report about Building 7 when a correspondent, Jane Stanley, I believe her name was, reported Building 7 going down 30 minutes before it happened.
That's right. That's mystified everybody. The panel hasn't looked at that yet because it's not all that straightforward what happened, but there was a statement from her about that building having fallen down before it did fall down. So
I think the time was mentioned in her broadcast, and I saw the video. It's been some time, but I think the time was clearly indicated, and it was just about 30 minutes before the building came down.
That's right. And
somebody got their wires crossed.
Not only that, but there were firemen. There were firemen outside warning the crowds to leave the area as early as 2:30 or 3 o'clock, saying this building is going to come down. And they had no reason to say that. A steel frame building has never collapsed in the history of steel frame buildings. It's never happened without controlled demolition. So three buildings on one day all collapse in the same manner. I mean, figure.
Oh, indeed. So it's been a while since I've written about this, but I wrote about the Oklahoma City bombing back in the 1990s, and a study was done at a U.S. Air Force base by a general. I forget if he was still active or retired, but a munitions expert conducted a study, and he concluded that the so-called car bomb blamed responsible for bringing down the Murrow Building in Oklahoma City. It was impossible that a car bomb was able to do this. And I remember writing about the extensive damage that went way beyond the building for blocks beyond it, causing damage to buildings for many blocks in all directions, not just shattering windows, but doing other things. It was a massive explosion, and he concluded that this was internally generated within the building and had nothing to do with a car bomb. So McVeigh and Nichols were blamed. Whether they had anything to do, I don't know if they had anything whatsoever to do with this, but they certainly were blamed for it. And if I remember right, I think McVeigh was executed. I think Nichols may be still in prison, but I have to go back and check that. But these guys essentially were wrongfully blamed for a self-generated, state-sponsored act of terrorism that nothing these guys had any involvement with or even the capability of doing. You had to go into the building and wire it to bring it down, and it really was kind of a precursor, I guess, for 9/11, Elizabeth.
It sounds that way very much, Stephen.
But the astonishing thing was that an Air Force general, it was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, did a study. It was right after this happened, and within weeks of that incident, he came up with his conclusion on what had happened, and I can't recall if there was anything reported about it. It certainly has been nothing for many, many years, and you would hear nothing about it now.
No. No, these people, the news has a short memory. It's always being, today's events are always displacing everything else. We just go on as if we don't have a history. Shall I go to the next point?
Yes, indeed. Well, I would say that Gore Vidal, the late Gore Vidal, and the late Stutz Terkel basically said the same thing. They referred to the country as the United States of Amnesia.
That's good. Yeah, I didn't hear that before. Our next point, there was an incredible phenomenon that went on for weeks after the towers collapsed down into this huge pile of rubble. And that was that underground, while they were removing pulling the girders out with big cranes to put them on the backs of flatbed trucks, these things had come out of the ground for weeks after, red hot, orange hot, dripping molten metal from deep down in the pile. And it's been a mystery to the investigators, the engineers who investigated before NIST wrote up its reports to basically sugarcoat everything. The early reports from the governments were saying, well, how could all this this heating be happening so deep down in the ground? And there were pieces of steel that with big girders that had holes in them like Swiss cheese. And this was a mystery to the fire investigators. So when NIST released its report, which did not refer to any of this, for weeks afterwards, people were wandering around on the piles, their gumboots were melting at the top. They had to keep changing their boots, and they were smoldering and smoking. When NIST was asked after it wrote its report, what about the molten metal underground? John Gross, who was one of the investigators, NIST investigators, said, "What molten metal? There wasn't any." And everybody just kind of sat back and said, "Well, look at these videos. Look at the molten metal dripping." Well, the NIST did not deal with this, which is a huge clue to how the buildings fell, the fact that there was all this heat. Because if they'd just fallen from being hit, 90 floors higher up and collapsed as a result in the pancake method that the government said they did, they collapsed under their own weight, there wouldn't be heat like that for weeks afterwards. So this is what our point Twin Tower 6, TT6, looks at in a very scientific way. And I could read you a couple of the things if you want, or maybe that's enough in itself. Hello?
Oh, yes, yeah. I'm listening.
Yeah, sorry. I think that probably covers that point sufficiently. I would direct people, if they wanted to get their mind around the total argument, which one of our engineers could probably give better than me. I'm a research librarian. That's my background. I work for the British Columbia Ministry of Health as the head librarian for the province of British Columbia for 25 years. So I'm not an engineer, but...
Elizabeth, for sure, I'm not either. If I could interject one point, I'm in no way an engineer. Technological nature sometimes make my eyes glaze over, but I remember the 9/11 date so vividly. And the whole thing of what happened absolutely didn't compute in my mind. And I may have mentioned it before in an older program that I remember that evening writing a letter to my brother saying something to the effect that they're drinking champagne in the White House tonight. I mean, this just opened the door for all kinds of possibilities for the White House. You get an event like this, and I had no idea what would follow. Who could, except the planners of what they had in mind. But the whole thing just didn't add up to me. There's never been anything like this in this country before. In the entire history of the country, even excluding the technological advances of today, but nothing like this approached event, and yet it happened, and it just didn't smell right. And the fact that the people named responsible were named and tracked down, and clues left all over the place. I mean, people who would plan a sophisticated crime of any type, they don't leave a trail behind so they can easily be found and tracked down and captured immediately. Anybody that's still alive, or if they're not alive, be named, be called the people who committed this thing. And yet, I mean, people left stuff in their trunk, supposedly, at the airport, incriminating them. Nobody does anything like that.
No, that's for sure. There's something else about this point that I should mention. They found a lot of these little iron spheres, and they would never, apparently, according to the physicists, they would not have been a byproduct of the melting of steel, but they are a byproduct of nanothermite. And they found a lot of nanothermite in the dust around the World Trade Center. That was a much earlier point that we did a couple of years ago, but there's a study on the use of explosives in the World Trade Center by 9 scientists that was published, and the lead author, who is a member of our panel, Dr. Niels Harrit, Harrit, he and 8 other people wrote an article on their discovery of this nanothermite, which is a really high-tech chemical that would never exist in nature. It's produced mostly in military laboratories, and it's only been around for about 20 years. And they found zillions of these tiny little chips in the World Trade Center dust. It was they were red on one side and gray on the other, and they were microscopic. And they thought they might be paint until they ignited them, and they flared. So that, with a huge amount of energy, each of these little things would flare. And when they subjected them to chemical analysis, they realized what it was. It was the uncombusted nanothermite that that had been used in some way within the towers. And that should not have been there. There shouldn't be a single chip of that anywhere in New York City. So that's pretty well, that's the smoking gun, one of the major smoking guns that should be mentioned often.
And Elizabeth, if I would add, I think what you're doing with the Consensus 9/11 initiative is so extremely important because you're uncovering factual information that debunks the official story. And the more of that that gets done, the more it puts to a lie the entire story, that the official story that claims what the government says, that so-called terrorists were responsible, et cetera, and so on, chapter and verse. And of course, David Ray Griffin wrote 10 books on 9/11, and one of them was the 9/11 Commission, and I forget his subtitle, but it basically was just taking apart the commission's findings piece by piece by piece and showing that they just were a pack of lies.
That's right. David Ray Griffin, he's a theologian, Dr. David Ray Griffin, has written his 10 books. I helped him with 7 of them, and he's been nominated 3 times in Europe for the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on those books. And one of those books was given the Publishers Weekly Award for Pick of the Week in 2009, and only 51 books get that award in the United States, 51 weeks of the year. They don't do Christmas, out of 175,000 published books. So that book, this gives you an idea, that book was never reviewed in the mainstream.
Oh, the
it
big
just tells
one,
you
the
where
big
we
ones
are
that
at.
Never reviewed, Elizabeth. The best books to know to stay away from are the ones that make the New York Times bestseller list. Absolutely avoid them. Don't throw your money away. I've been offered a number of times to take a 2-week, a 3-week free subscription to my Chicago Tribune, and somebody would call me on the phone, and I think at least once I very politely said something to the effect that I would really appreciate not having this stuff appear on my doorstep. I honestly don't want it on a full-time basis free because I wouldn't waste my time reading it. I must say I do check it every now and then online because I like to quote something from it that I want to debunk. Either on the wrong side of history or a bald-faced lie, something to that extent. But I just couldn't imagine throwing my money away on the Tribune, on the New York Times, on any of them.
No, especially when you can get them free online.
You can get them free online. Most of them you can get free online. And usually, even though some of them make you pay for online stuff, sometimes you can access some of their material. I do it to quote stuff from major media publications because I do a lot of media critiques. I will see the usual kind of stuff that comes out next week on 9/11, Elizabeth. Instead of talking about the important things, they'll be mourning the victims without saying a word about the perpetrators. Traitors, the real ones.
Yeah. Shall we do one last point?
I think we have about 3 or 4 minutes, so let's take an important point, and maybe you can summarize it.
Okay. Everybody remembers the Todd Beamer call, which was the "Let's Roll" call from Flight 93, which ultimately crashed out in Pennsylvania, and that's the one where the passengers took control of they wrested control away from the hijackers, and the plane in the process went nosediving into a field and totally buried itself. And this phone call, from which we know all that, what happened, was made by a man called Todd Beamer, and he made it to a telephone supervisor called Lisa Jefferson. But there's a huge problem there are actually many huge problems with this call, but the one we discovered most recently is that there's a problem with the timeline, because the official report the official report had the call happening at a completely different time than the Moussaoui trial records. The Moussaoui trial, this is a bit complicated, the Moussaoui trial happened in 2006, and the FBI presented at the Moussaoui trial all the telephone records from the planes on 9/11. And they differed by 20 minutes from the time that the Jefferson timing was reported. So it's just, there were other problems with the Beamer call too, and that we have two points that go in depth into these problems. Point PC1A, which is the new one, and that's phone call one and phone call, and the earlier one that predated it. Another problem with Beamer's call was that the 9/11 Commission report stated that there were struggles and shouts of Mayday and get out of here from the cockpit during the hijacking. And Jefferson, who received the call about the passenger revolt, she said that there was an unusually low amount of background noise, and that Mr. Beamer seemed unusually collected and calm given what was going on around him. And the other thing was that she spoke to him for a long time. I think it was about 45 minutes went on. She was surprised that any call that morning would last for 45 minutes. And during that time, he never asked to speak to his wife, which was what he ostensibly had been wanting to do. So we have some conclusions that show that there's a lot of really suspicious doubt and to some of these calls that the whole 9/11 story from the skies was based on.
Oh, suspicion after suspicion after suspicion, Elizabeth. It really is astonishing. A final comment. We are getting right up to the end of the program.
For me?
Yes.
Yes. I think if people are probably saying, well, what can I do about this? Given the context now of the coming, the attempt to invade Syria, I think all this wraps together into one big program, kind of a subterranean program that's moving along in spite of what's going on, with who's in charge as president and who's in the Congress and so on. These intentions are coming from the military-industrial complex, and it's up to people to stand up and start making as much of a fuss as they can and say, we want our democracy back.
Elizabeth, I concur with that 100%. People power can have final say if it only wants it, and the best way to do it is to do it nonviolently. The history of the world shows that that works. It works best. Civil disobedience, okay. Violence, not okay if it gets more of it. Elizabeth, thanks so much. This was an important hour. We'll continue the 9/11 story tomorrow with Graham McQueen. I look forward to that. Join us again at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Elizabeth.